Hello and welcome back to the podcast that is always up to speed with Formula One. Mark and Mark Daly and Hamilton back to talk about our favorite obsession. I'm not going to say sport, I'm going to say obsession. I'm just going to be straight up and honest about it. But hey, how's it going? You got a big smile on your face. The weather is nice. Spring has finally sprung here on the West Coast. And well, we shouldn't get too excited. I noticed in the forecast this afternoon that the rain is coming. And you can always count on the Pacific Northwest to do what it does best. And that is rain at some point. But the past 10 days have been absolutely awesome. And I'm not really ready to hunker down and stay inside for the next week. But that's what it's looking like. But hey, that's what we do here, and we complain about the weather, so by virtue, you are an all-now honorary Vancouverite, so feel free to join in or shake your heads at my whining. But it's all good. It's all good. We're not going to whine about anything Formula One, because, Mark, there's been some pretty interesting stories floating around this week. There's been some interesting sort of, I guess, fallout, if you want to call it that, from last weekend's Grand Prix at Imola. Of course, the big story that's still going around is the aftermath of the Russell and Bottas accident. And then there was an interesting story about Kimi Raikkonen and that penalty that he got at the end of the race, because basically we can sum it up. We'll go into it in a little bit of detail. Was when we had that rolling start again, and he went off, and he was supposed to rejoin. He was a little bit unclear as how what they were supposed to do, and they radioed the race director. They didn't get back in time, and they said, okay, the rules are unclear, but hey, you still got to serve the penalty. You know, it's just like, a couple of weeks ago, we were complaining about how infuriating it was to see the lack of enforcement for track limits in Bahrain. And this weekend, you get an equally bizarre situation. So they're being consistently inconsistent, but that is what it is. But how are you doing, my friend?
I appreciate you asking. And it's funny you were talking about the weather. We don't typically have hot spells during April here in Vancouver, British Columbia, but last weekend it was touching on the high 20s, close to 30. So I got to spend Saturday at the beach, and I got a brutal tan. And it's kind of funny too, to go to the beach when the trees themselves haven't even blossomed or bloomed, like the leaves weren't out. It was kind of a surreal experience. But yeah, we had an awesome weekend in the sun. It was super nice. To your point, it's probably gonna be wet for the next 10 days. I got my vaccine this week, my first shot, so I'm super excited about that. And I also had a really interesting experience at work that I kind of want to share. But I was on a conference call a couple of days ago, as we're apt to do in this new world of work from home and digital immersion with your coworkers. But we had a call, and at the beginning of the call, a director that was on the call, knowing that I was on the call, actually made reference to last weekend's race. And he's like, cool. It was a great race. And he was talking about the race. And then somebody else chimed in and commented on the race. And then a senior VP, a vice president of the company, was also on the call. And he chimed in about the race and was speaking about Verstappen, and actually pronounced his name better than I typically do. So it was just this surreal experience of being on a conference call in Canada, and I wasn't the one driving the conversation about the last race. It was really interesting, and it also just speaks to how rapidly the sport's growing. And I think the acknowledgement from the bulk of the folks on this call was that their initial immersion into the sport was Netflix Drive to Survive. And that's kind of what they referenced as kind of their gateway into the sport. So as much as we talk about it with our fans and so many of the people that listen to the show, that they've kind of entered the world of Formula One through that as a gateway, it's very much the truth. And I see it in my workplace all the time. But I thought that was really, really interesting. And I got excited, not just because I have more people to talk about Formula One with at work, but it just speaks to how rapidly the fan base for the sport is growing currently, which I think is very, very cool.
It's really cool. I've had a couple of friends too that have been messaging me recently and saying, DTS, you watch or don't watch? Is it worth it? And I'm like, absolutely, right now. And they're like, well, which season should I start with? I've never watched Formula One before. I said, well, seriously, start with season one. I mean, you can watch any season apart, but if you really want to get the full experience, watch all three seasons and tell me what you think. But it is really kind of cool. Like you say, I mean, for years, I felt like after a big race, I'm sort of like bursting and ready to talk about it with people. And then there's been very few people that in my circle that I knew of that were Formula One fans. But slowly but surely, like you say, it is, well, actually more than slowly now. I mean, especially this year, what with people staying home more and digesting and consuming digital media a lot more, that this DTS has really sprung out as one of the standouts. Last year, it was Tiger King. I guess this year it's Drive to Survive. So I know which one I'm going to put down as my favorite, and shouldn't come as any surprise, of course. But it's interesting because I felt like for the longest time, I felt like the sole member of what could be like this really awesome tribe of Formula One fans around the world. And all of a sudden, people that I know that, you know, I'm fairly close with or good friends with, or even colleagues or, you know, some people in my professional circle, just like yourself, that they're starting to talk about Formula One. I'm like, guys, where have you been all these years? Finally, welcome. Come on, sit down. Let's talk. There's a lot to talk about. So it's cool. It's really awesome to be able to share the passion and all the cool stuff about Formula One.
The one thing I would add as well, and I agree with everything you're saying, I think the one thing that Drive to Survive does well above everything else is it helps new fans connect with the personalities of the sport. And I think if you're not familiar with F1 and you look at it from a distance, it's just a bunch of noisy cars with European drivers, and it's really hard to connect. And that's the perception, right? But I think one of the things that Drive to Survive does so well is it brings you into the paddock and you get to know the drivers, you get to know the team principal. And because the sport's so well endowed right now with these charismatic, really personable drivers, it kind of sucks you in. And then you tune in every week, not because you're looking to see that silver Mercedes or you're looking to see that orange McLaren, but you're looking to see what Daniel Ricciardo does. And you know Daniel Ricciardo because you saw him in an episode where he was on his family farm back in Australia. I think that's what it does really well. It helps introduce you to the personality of these drivers. And I think that's where that connection, that human connection is starting. So yeah, super exciting. And I know we got a ton of stuff to get to, so we can probably move on from the Drive to Survive banter.
Well, it's sort of related. I mean, it's a direct result of the Gen DTS or the Drive to Survive phenomena. But I mean, this is a story that's been developing for a long time. And so we talked about it briefly last week on the show that Miami is going to be joining the calendar for 2022, which is awesome. It's going to be slated in Q2 of next year. So obviously, we're thinking, we were talking about a little bit earlier off air, Mark, that we're thinking that we're going to be seeing a Montreal-Miami back-to-back schedule or portion to the schedule, which I think is awesome because, you know, you're going to get those first several races in Europe instead of just coming over to Montreal for that one date at the beginning of June. My guess is that they're going to go from Montreal to Miami or vice versa. And I think it's awesome then back to Europe for the bulk of the remainder of the European season in the summer break. I'm really excited about it. I think it's really good. I mean, I know that there's been some local opposition, which, you know, isn't ideal, but, you know, compared to some of the races in other countries that, you know, we're not really excited about for obvious, you know, the sports washing, right? This is, in comparison, something that you can get more excited about because, you know, the issues that are facing it are a lot less major when it comes to, you know, serious issues like human rights.
Right. And I've said this before on the show. I think one of the things that I'm most interested in when it comes to Formula One is the business side of the sport. And Miami has always been a target destination for Liberty. So Liberty is effectively the principal financial backer of the sport. Liberty Media came in, they bought Formula One, it was probably 4 or 5 years ago. Was it late 2016 at this
stage?
It's
about time, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, late 2016, early 2017. So they basically bought the sport. And it wasn't clear initially what their intentions were. Were they going to shine it up, invest in it a little bit, and spin it off? Was it a long-term investment? Regardless, I think Liberty had always identified that the biggest growth opportunity for the sport is the United States. This is a sport that is very, very heavy on their European presence, largely because that's kind of the birthplace of the sport. Mm-hmm. But I think from Liberty's perspective, look, if we're going to grow and continue to monetize this sport, we've got this country of 360 million people with a single race. Yet in Europe, we have a calendar of 12, 15 races. Mm-hmm. So it was always very clear that from Liberty's perspective, if they wanted to grow the sport of the United States. What we do know about Miami is that they will not be paying any hosting fees to the Formula One group. This is a freebie. And from Liberty's perspective, that's okay because it's going to help provide additional exposure in the United States. And ultimately, exposure translates into a couple of things. One, it helps them crack the U.S. sponsorship market. So if you look at the principal sponsors in Formula One at the team level, at the kind of Formula One level, most of them aren't typically American corporations. They're typically European or Asian corporations. So as long as you continue to build your footprint in the US, you can potentially penetrate some of those corporate sponsorships. The other thing it allows you to do is really crack open the opportunities that exist from a TV revenue perspective. So right now they've got a deal with ESPN. It doesn't pay them a lot of money. And a big chunk of that's because historically the ratings are really low. So the hope from Liberty's perspective is, look, we continue to build on the success at COTA and Austin. We put a race in Miami. Potentially we put a third race in this country. We continue to increase the exposure. We continue to increase those ratings. And then we can go back to ESPN/ABC, or we can go to NBC, or we can go to Fox, and we can really go in with some leverage and negotiate a bigger TV deal. So this is all about growing and continuing to monetize the sport. But at the same time, on the one hand, I want to be critical of this event, right? Let's, for all intents and purposes, it's a race in a parking lot at a football stadium 20 minutes north of downtown Miami. Like, if you want to super, super simplify it, there's no elevation gains. It's going to be relatively tight. There isn't going to be a ton of passing zones. But I'm going to put this back to a comment that I saw on Reddit the other day where everyone was just dumping all over this race. It's terrible. It's a parking lot. It's not a traditional track, blah, 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 blah. And somebody had made this comment that really resonated with me. It's like, you know what, guys? You're allowed to have fun. As a Formula One fan, you're allowed to have fun every now and then. And Miami, at the very worst, is just going to be a fun event. So I kind of came around on it, and I'm kind of excited to see what this 19-corner, 5-kilometer track is ultimately going to look like. But yeah, to your point, we don't have to wait long. Second quarter of next year, probably going to be paired with Canada back-to-back, whether it's before or after, I don't know, but they've secured a 10-year deal, so we're going to be seeing a lot of Miami over the next decade.
Yeah, it becomes like one of those destination events for Formula One fans. You know, like a lot of people will always say, well, Montreal is such a great race to go to because there's so many good things to do. Well, in normal times, there's so much going on in Montreal. There's a lot of culture. There's a great nightlife. You know, the Formula One, they love going there themselves. So Miami obviously has got a lot going on that front as well. And the one thing I thought was kind of interesting too, looking at the initial layout of the track around Hard Rock Stadium and also just the location, the immediate parallel that came into my mind was Sochi, right? Similar kind of track, you know, it's flat as a table. And so it's an interesting looking layout. I mean, it's got some very tight, twisty sections and, you know, a very long straightaway on the back there, and then between sort of halfway around, a very long straight kind of sweeping portion of the track, which kind of reminds me very, it's not quite as drastic as the Circuit of the Americas, but it has that sort of similar vibe to it. So it'll be interesting to see what it's like. And I think if you jump onto social media, there have been some simulations that certain people have been posting, so you can get a virtual run around of the circuit already. So that should be pretty cool.
It's funny, by the way, that you mentioned Sochi, because I don't know if you noticed, but after Formula One had posted about the race on Instagram, Marcus Ericsson had actually responded, and his comment was Sochi 2.0. So it's funny that your observation was exactly the same. And for those of you that are listening that are new to the sports, Sochi isn't a well-regarded track, and it's one that I think a lot of Formula One fans would be quite happy to see disappear from the calendar.
Well, the only person that wouldn't want to see it disappear from the calendar is Valtteri Bottas, because that seems to be the one track that he absolutely owns. So he would be the one guy that would be very disappointed to see Sochi disappear from the circuit. But sticking with the theme of the U.S. and Formula One, Mario Andretti has given a tap on the shoulder to the American driver that he wants to see in Formula One, and that is IndyCar driver Colton Herta. And I think this is interesting because, I mean, the last American that we saw was Alexander Rossi, and you know, he had 5 outings back in 2015. So I mean, it's well overdue, and that's the thing. I mean, you can get a couple of races in the United States, like in Miami, in Austin, but that's the next thing, is not only the American sponsorship. I mean, I'll be convinced that they're really making an inroads into the American psyche in general, not just immersed into the sporting mentality and sporting interest of people across the country. But when I start seeing American companies branding on the side of Formula One cars, and most importantly, to see an American driver, I mean, because that'll be ultimately, I think, a driver that people can identify and relate to. Because otherwise, it was funny because what you were saying that, you know, all these European races, all these European drivers. And the one thing when you were saying that kept popping into my mind was Sacha Baron Cohen's character from, you know, Ricky Bobby, right? You know, so is that stereotype, you know, here am I talking about stereotypes here. I'm a Canadian guy wearing a hockey sweater while we're doing a podcast, but that's another story. But, you know, just joking aside, I mean, we need to see that. And I think that'd be the one, you know, the one thing that would really show that there's some serious, you know, some serious inroads being made in Formula One. And that's why I thought it was interesting that Herta was actually, you know, pointed to by Mario that he's the guy that he wants to see in Formula One, because, you know, we talked about it, what, maybe a month or two ago? Like, who would be that guy? Who could potentially be that American driver to get into Formula One? And now here we go, just a month or so later, his name sort of pops up.
It is really a funny thought, right? You think about COTA and you think about the U.S. Grand Prix in Austin, that for the better part of the last 5 or 6 years, you have 150,000 people funneling into that track over the race weekend, and there's no U.S. driver to cheer mm-hmm. on. Like, yep. Potentially, we're going to go to Miami next year, and there's no American driver to cheer on. And this is a country that, for all intents and purposes, dominates in every conceivable sport and motorsport, yet they've really never had, at least in the last 2 or 3 decades, a really tangible American presence. And I think part of that is that in the 90s, in the late 80s, you could argue that, at least from an American perspective, IndyCar before the splits was a relatively powerful open-wheel racing series in its own right.
It was, yeah.
But I think the Colton Herta comment is probably a good one, and it he could conceivably be a good fit. Now, he's not had a Formula One test. He's not a test driver. He's not a reserve driver. But he is young. He has won at the IndyCar Series level. He won, I think, his third race in that series, which was pretty remarkable. He's been running a Honda-powered car for the last couple of years. But most importantly, his background and the foundation of his open-wheel racing actually happened in Europe. He competed in Euro Formula, Spanish Formula 3. So he's familiar with that level of racing. He's familiar with that psychology of racing. He's familiar with those type of vehicles. And he's also raced against a lot of current Formula One drivers in his past life. So he could conceivably be a good fit. And the other thing about him as well is that, like, from a personality perspective, he's a really good kid, just like mm-hmm. so many of the young drivers in Formula One. Like, he would be a good fit. And I think from a Formula One perspective, he's very, very, very marketable. This is a yeah. guy that you could take to the sponsors, you can put on TV, that fans would rally around. But I think you're absolutely right. The next best thing for Formula One is continue to establish your footprint in the United States by building on the races. But you've got to get an American driver. And you've got to get an American driver that can stick for more than a couple of years and that can actually compete for podiums.
Yeah, absolutely. And at 21 years old, he was really in that sweet spot with a lot of the other top young drivers like Leclerc, Verstappen, Lando Norris. I mean, George Russell, all those guys in their early 20s. So, I mean, he would be a perfect fit like that. And if he could catch on and stick and be competitive, I mean, conceivably, he could be in Formula One for quite a while. So, I mean, I completely see where Mario's going with this. Anyways, Mark, time for a quick break here on the show. When we come back, I want to talk about why Toto Wolff is feeling pretty confident. And we'll find out why he's confident about something right here in just a moment. So don't go away. We'll be right back. Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Have you ever experienced turbulence on a flight and wondered why?
And you can see all the terrain around you. You've got no issue with visibility or anything?
No, everything's peachy.
Maybe you've sat on the tarmac for hours wondering why your plane isn't moving.
Well, we're outside here. They're saying the ramp is closed. They won't let us park because of Air Force One.
Listen in on the conversations between pilots and air traffic controllers on the Air Traffic Out of Control podcast.
510 is declaring an emergency. There's smoke in the cabin. I need to make a landing right now on 31 left.
We have the most interesting, wild, and funny ATC recordings you will ever hear. Check out Air Traffic Out of Control wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
All right, well, welcome back to the show. Mark and Mark breaking down all the latest Formula One news. And we were talking before the break about the addition of Miami, the possibility or the wish of Mario Andretti to see Colton Herta in Formula One. And, well, I was just hinting at it before the break there. Toto Wolff, he's feeling confident. And what he's feeling confident about is that we're going to get a minimum of 17 races in this year. And obviously, last year that was way up in the air, what with the pandemic starting and everything like that. We're still slated for 23 races, pardon me. It sounded like about a week or so that Canada was facing the chop, but that's been pretty quiet. It was pretty much reported as a fact by CBC, you know, our national broadcaster, and it hasn't been confirmed one way or another other than Formula One is still in talks with the race organizer. And I have to think that the longer this goes on, that it's more likely it's going to happen, but I'm positive. I'm buoyed by the fact that Toto Wolff, I mean, somebody of his stature is coming out and saying that he's confident that we're going to see 17 races. And although at the beginning of last season, I was thinking, oh, well, that's such a drag that, you know, we're going to lose so many races compared to what we're going to have last year. It was 22, right? It was 22 races last year, I think, originally. But I mean, to get 17 races out of it, I know we had several races where we were at the same venue, but it still worked. And I think that if we could get 17 races at 17 different tracks this year. I mean, obviously, I want to see all 23, but the situation is fluid and it's, you know, obviously better in some places than other. But I'm happy to hear Toto feel that that this is going to be at least 17 races, if not more.
It's funny because when I saw this article at first, I thought he was being really pessimistic. And then if you start to look at the calendar, you look at some of these events that are potentially at risk, specifically Brazil. At this point in time, it's hard to imagine we're going to Brazil this year. And a lot can happen between now and the first week of November, but it's really hard to imagine that we're potentially going to go there. It's very difficult to imagine even that we might go to Japan. This is a country that between now and that race is still planning to hold the 2020 Summer Olympics. Only 1 or 2% of the national population has been vaccinated. It's difficult to imagine that we would go there. So I think we need to brace for the fact that probably 2, 3, or 4 races will be dropped from this calendar. So when you start to think it in those terms, like, yeah, you know what, 17 is probably the realistic number. The upside would probably be 18 or 19 or 20 races, but yeah, I don't think we're going to see 23. Now, the interesting thing, of course, is that we still have Bahrain, which is ready to go 24/7, 365 days a year. So that's a track that's always accessible. It's just not necessarily the easiest track to get to. And it's funny too, because originally, of course, the Australian Grand Prix was supposed to open the season. And if that wasn't still the case, it would have been a really good fit to simply have pulled out Brazil, stuck in Bahrain, and then followed that up with Saudi Arabia and Jos Marina, because they could have gone back to back to back.
Exactly. Right.
And sorry.
No, I was going to say, you know, if you go back to Bahrain, I'd love to see that outer ring like we saw last year. I mean, it was amazing, that sub-minute lap that they were doing. It was like a go-kart track. It was absolutely phenomenal.
To be honest, selfishly, I'm looking at the calendar right now. Where could we fit it in? Could we fit it in between Sochi and Japan? I will find a way. But that was awesome. And that's one of the great things about that track is, one, because it's out literally out in the desert and it's a government-owned and run track, you don't necessarily have to worry about local opposition and contracts. You can stick a race there whenever you want to. But to your point, it's really flexible in the way that you can reconfigure the track. So you can almost go to that semi-oval that drives those kind of sub-60-second lap times. It's pretty exciting. But yeah, I think ultimately, I don't think we're going to see 23 races. I don't think we'll see 20, but I think anything in the high teens would probably be considered a success.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I keep thinking too about what's going to happen in here with the Canadian Grand Prix at the beginning of June. And, you know, it's still being thrown out there that Montreal will get dropped and we'll go back to Istanbul, we'll go to Turkey in place. And geographically, it makes sense. I mean, we're going to Portugal, totally. Then we're going to Spain, we're going to Monaco, then we're going to Baku for the Azerbaijan Grand Prix. And then geographically, from Azerbaijan and to Turkey to France, I mean, they're not all side by side, but I mean, it logistically, it's a lot easier to go from Baku to Turkey and then to France. I mean, we're looking at flights of just a couple of hours here or there from venue to venue, and it's a lot easier to get the cars and the equipment and the team personnel from those tracks from going from Baku all the way to Montreal and then back to France. So we'll see what happens. I mean, obviously, if Montreal doesn't happen, we'll be disappointed because it'll be the second year in a row that the Canadian Grand Prix doesn't take place. But like yourself, I mean, if we can push upward in the high teens to maybe 20 races, if that's what it comes out at, I'll be perfectly happy. I mean, obviously, 23 would be ideal or would be the perfect scenario. But I think the situation is still fluid. It's going to be changing. And we just have to brace ourselves for the loss of some races at some point.
And let me ask you this question.
Sure.
So the calendar kind of shapes up this. You know what? May 23rd, we're in Monaco. That's going to go ahead. The track's already largely assembled. We follow that up by going to Azerbaijan for Baku on June 6th. A week later, we're supposed to be on the other side of the world in Montreal. And then 2 weeks later, we're supposed to be back across the world again in France. If you're not going to put spectators in Montreal, if you're going to go there and you're going to race in front of empty grandstands, why go at all? Why not just, to your point, put the race in Istanbul? Turkey's ready to go. The track's ready. It's been resurfaced recently. Why move the entire infrastructure of the sport all the way across the world when you can take that three-hour flight from Baku to Turkey and just be done with it? Like, to me, it makes no sense. Like, I don't want to see Canada off the calendar, but for the sake of the health and well-being of everyone involved in the sport, it doesn't make any sense to come all the way to Montreal for a race that's not happening in front of fans. Simply move it to Istanbul for this 1 year.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, last year in Istanbul, I mean, it was a great race. I mean, the track had only been surfaced. They'd only finished it like a week or 10 days before. I mean, the track, it was still really green, the asphalt. You throw the rain on there. I mean, it made for a spectacular weekend. I mean, it was no fun if you were actually driving the car, but I think for everybody that was watching, it was a lot of fun to watch. But I mean, just in general, I mean, you have that, it's a great track to watch, especially, was it that turn eight or whatever it is with the triple apex on it? That is one of the coolest corners, I think, that we see in Formula One at any given time. So it certainly, I wouldn't mind losing Montreal this year. I mean, if it means that we come back next year, we can put people in the stands and it's more normal, because I mean, there's always a great atmosphere there, and it just to
absolutely
see it. But I mean, that goes for so many other venues that that Formula One goes to around the world each and every time. But it and I think that's why it looked so weird last week in Imola, where you had a racetrack in Italy and there was nobody in the stands there. I mean, there was like a big Ferrari banner up in the grandstands across from the pits. And I mean, the track is literally in the middle of the village there. And I mean, you could see people in their back gardens, but it looks so weird because you'd expect to see a sea of red and like all the smoke bombs going off with the red and the white and all, you know, all those cool things. So certainly the sooner we can get back to that, the better. But, you know, Mark, before we get into some of the other news, I just want to throw this in because we're going to go into a break here in a couple of minutes. And I think this is a kind of an interesting one to have because we've talked about this among ourselves back and forth. But it is interesting, you know, Liberty's been in control of the sport now for several years. And I can't help but thinking, this is just one thought that sort of pops up in my mind every once in a while is, okay, we're a year into a pandemic. We saw all these things go through over the past year. We saw the emergency measures approved by all the teams. We saw a new Concord agreement, all these new regulations, the cost cap, and all this that was agreed to in near record time. And I can't help but wondering, what would have happened to Formula One if Liberty had not come on board 5 years ago and Bernie Ecclestone was still running the show? I mean, nothing against Bernie. I mean, he did what he did. He built the sport into what it was over 40 years or whatever it might be. But when I look at where Formula One is now and what they're doing and the fact that they're still making this thing work still in the middle of a global pandemic, it just that question just keeps popping up. It's like, what if Bernie was still running the show?
Yeah, I think you and I talked about this offline a couple of times as well. And I look back at last year and we talk about the fact that the sport went to Australia and they made a very difficult but tactical strategic decision that they were going to cancel that race in the middle of the race weekend. I don't think Bernie does that. No. I think Bernie forces that race through. He ignores all imaginable health authorities and he makes it happen. And I think you would have had to drag him kicking and screaming out of a boardroom to cancel any of the races last season. But the other consideration too is last year was really unique. We had the pandemic, but we also had a number of different social justice movements. And one of the thing, and I was critical of the way it was handled. I didn't think it was entirely well executed. I think they could have done more. I think they could have marketed in different ways. But the sport also, at a certain level, embraced the Black Lives Matter movement as well. I don't see Bernie going anywhere near any social justice movements. No, but you're absolutely right. I think Bernie's inability to manage through crisis could have broken the sport last year in so many ways. I don't think he would have had the confidence of the teams. I don't think he would have had the confidence of the drivers. I don't think they would have trusted that he had their best interests in mind. I don't think the teams would have trusted his business acumen. I think last year could have been a make or break season with Bernie, and I think he could have broken the sport.
Yeah, you really can't help but come to that conclusion, and especially when you think about all these major things that were pushed through. And I mean, especially the most recent one was the whole Red Bull takeover the Honda IP, right? I just could not see. I mean, there was some opposition there. There was a bit of friction there and I mean, we don't really know the true extent of that, but I just do not see that happening under the guidance of Bernie Ecclestone, especially the whole Red Bull taking it over, but then also the whole engine freeze part. It'd be like, well, you know, you buy Honda if you want to. If you can't make it work, that's fine. But you know, we're not going to change. We're not freezing the rules or the regulations. We're not changing anything else. You either do it or you don't. And you know, if it doesn't work for you, then too bad. Yeah. Anyway, so let's take another break here, Mark. We're a little bit ahead of schedule, but it'll be a good place to break because we're going to come back. And I want to talk about Danny Ricciardo. And I want to get your take on this. I think his start at McLaren so far this year, I think you can maybe call it a little bit kind of lukewarm. I don't think he's really set any fires, and made it a real amazing start at McLaren. But anyways, we'll talk about that a little bit after the break, and we'll do so in just a moment. So don't go away. We'll be back in just a moment. All right, well, welcome back to the show. Thank you for downloading and listening to the show on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, wherever you get your podcasts from, and for all of you tuning in and watching on YouTube. We're talking about all the latest Formula One news, and this was one, an article that popped up I thought was quite interesting about Danny Ricciardo saying he had to swallow his pride in the swap with his teammate Lando Norris at Imola last weekend. I mean, if you look at the driver standings right now, you have Lewis on top with and Max Verstappen only a single point behind. You have Lando Norris, the McLaren driver, first of the McLaren drivers. He's third in the world championship at the moment, 27 points. And his teammate Ricciardo all the way down in seventh with 14 points. And I think Ricciardo, obviously, there's going to be a bit of a settling in period for any new driver with the new team. But considering what we've seen Danny Ricciardo do, and this McLaren is obviously a good car. It's got a good engine in it, obviously, with the Mercedes power unit. And I don't want to say I'm disappointed in what Danny Ricciardo has done so far in the first couple of races with McLaren, but he's not really lighting it up. I don't know if he's just still finding his feet there, but I don't think it's maybe going quite the way that Ricciardo himself expected.
It's a really interesting point you bring up, and it's not one that I've put a lot of thought into. I think the consideration is this, right? Lando Norris has been in that team since 2018. So he didn't race in any Grand Prix in 2018, but he did extensive testing. He raced the entire 2019 calendar in that car. He raced the entire 2020 calendar in that car. And of course, he's a member of the team this year. So he has a tremendous amount of familiarity with their mechanics, with their engineers. You could say, and I hate this phrase because it sounds so cliche, but you could say that car was really built around him. That said, he's adjusting to the new motor as much as Daniel Ricciardo is adjusting to that new car. Lando's had a great start. He finished fourth in Bahrain. He was on the podium at Imola last weekend. Daniel Ricciardo, a seventh place finish, a sixth place finish, maybe not great, but not necessarily terrible either. Like, healthy in the points. I think it's a little bit early. If we get to Azerbaijan, or if we get to Canada or Turkey or wherever we end up racing, and he's still consistently 3, 4, 5 grid spots behind his teammate, I think that's when we can start becoming a little bit alarmed, or we can start settling into the realization that, hey, Lando may just be that top tier premier talent that you and I have kind of suggested that maybe he is, right? Like, this could be less a criticism of Daniel Ricciardo ultimately, but really just an acknowledgement that Lando Norris might be one of the absolutely premier up and coming talents in the sport.
Yeah, absolutely. I totally agree. I mean, how often have we talked about it over the years that Max Verstappen has done a lot more with that Red Bull than he probably should? I mean, is this a case that Lando Norris is doing the same with the McLaren? I mean, the McLaren's a good car. I think that they're obviously in a much better place now than they were a couple of years ago. But is he just being able to extract that much more out of that car than his teammate is? I mean, obviously, like you say, I mean, you make a great point that he's been in the team for a couple of years now, and maybe he just is one of these drivers that just has that natural ability to do that. I mean, if you go and read James Allen's book about Michael Schumacher, he was able, one of these guys, to take and push the car to the edge of the envelope and beyond, and just to find performance and grip that you wouldn't find, mere mortals would be able to do. I mean, you go back to France a couple of years ago in Lando's rookie season, and what did he have? Was it a hydraulic failure or something in the last couple of laps of the race? I mean, he was on for a good solid points finish. I mean, he struggled home in 9th or 10th or something like that. But I mean, I think that was an indication right there that, okay, this guy is for real. I mean, maybe other drivers would have parked it and retired the car, but he managed to fight it and bring it home. And it just kind of goes back to that season as well, or maybe even before, we had France tossed the team principal at AlphaTauri, or Toro Rosso was back there, because they had the Kiwi driver in the car, was his name, Brendan Hartley, and he wasn't really doing, he wasn't really setting Formula One on fire, and I think Tost had thrown it out there in the media that he wanted to arrange maybe some sort of deal where they could bring Lando into Toro Rosso on some sort of temporary basis for the remainder of that season and for 2018 or something like that. It was some sort of arrangement like that. And Zach Brown, he flat out shot it out of the water and said, it's not going to happen. Our plan is to get Lando into this car as soon as possible, because we know that he's the real deal. He's well deserving of a seat in Formula One, and we want to get this guy in a car. And I mean, he's proven Zach's faith in him, he's proven it. He's paid it back and beyond. And I think that's really what, what we're seeing at the moment. And I think some of the quotes that Brown was even saying this week is that past weekend at Imola was Zach's definitely at the next level. I mean, one premier names in Formula One. But Lando was really taking that next step as a driver. And I think that, it's exciting to see, these young drivers. It doesn't matter if it's Max Verstappen, Lando Norris, and then, some of maybe the unproven other names. I mean, Leclerc is one of those guys that's obviously proven himself. I mean, if we get another one of these guys in Lando Norris that turns out to be, like you say, like a premier talent in Formula One, then that's going to be exciting for the sport for the next 10 years. I mean, you've got Leclerc, Verstappen, and Lando Norris all in their early 20s. You get these guys in competitive cars, and then, maybe George Russell, maybe this guy's for real. You get him into a good car as well. It could be some very, very exciting times coming up in the future.
This is why Formula One needs to be really excited about where they are right now in terms of appealing to a younger demographic.
Absolutely.
Like, I'm looking at the driver lineup right now. Lewis appeals to a broader demo. He's charismatic, he's personable, he's a marketable star. But you and I both know he's probably not going to be in the sport for probably more than 2 or 3 more years.
Yeah.
Max Verstappen, younger driver, huge appeal, unique personality, super hard ed, ultra competitive, one of the best in the sport. Lando Norris, young, compelling, charismatic. Charles Leclerc, the same. Valtteri, probably going to be out of the sport shortly. Carlos, young, talented, personable. Daniel Ricciardo, probably middle-aged by driver standards, but still a big personality. And then you keep going. You've got Lance Stroll, Yuki. You've got George Russell, Nicholas Latifi, like there's so much great, and Mick Schumacher, there's so much great young talent in this sport mm-hmm. that speaks the same language as the young demographic that is being catered to with programs like Drive to Survive. I just think the sport's in a really great place. Now, just going back to that McLaren thing real quick, I just have to reinforce this point once again. What they're doing this year, despite having gone through the massive organ transplant that is replacing a Renault power unit with a Mercedes power unit in a single off season, is remarkable. Like, I think you have to remember that these Formula One cars are built from the inside out. You basically choose a power unit, you either build it yourself or you buy that power unit, and you build a car around it to complement the characteristics of that motor. The car that McLaren is driving was fundamentally designed for a Renault power unit, and they wedged a Mercedes power unit into that car over the winter, and they haven't skipped a beat. They're third in the Constructors, and I know it's early, two races in, but they're third in the Constructors Championship and up on Ferrari by 7 points. I think as a package, that team's doing some really good things. And while I agree, Daniel Ricciardo's performance may be a little bit lukewarm so far, two races in, let's see what it looks like after four or five.
Yeah, it's absolutely early days. But just more to your point about these young, marketable, really personable drivers, as much as I enjoy watching Max driving, especially now that he's kind of matured a little bit, and we don't see the things like the Verstappen slide into the corners and that those double moves and things that, you know, he's kind of grown out or maybe it's been legislated out of the sport to a certain extent. But the one thing is when I look at guys like Lando, definitely, well, Ricardo being a little bit older and Lance and Nick Latifi, all these young drivers, is that compared to a lot of these other guys, and, you know, being half Dutch myself, you know, I understand a lot of the cultural side, the personality side, but I just find Max, I find his personality sometimes a little bit kind of abrasive. You know what I mean?
It is definitely abrasive.
Yeah.
He is not the warm, fuzzy, inviting, accessible driver that, mm-hmm. that Lando or Charles or George Russell or Nicholas Latifi are. But I think that's also part of the appeal, right? Is he can get away with it because he's a successful driver. If he was 20th on the driver's standings, that wouldn't fly, but he gets away with it because of the way he races.
Yeah, and the other thing is, too, is that the personality that he has, that, you know, he often speaks what's on his mind. He doesn't kind of sugarcoat it, that sometimes, in being in the media myself, there's the one thing I always hated was just that you ask an athlete a question, you get all these kind of like, you know, these metaphors, you know, that our back's up against the wall, we've got to dig deep, or these real political wishy-washy non-answers. I mean, Max quite often is pretty blunt and will say what's on his mind, which I find refreshing. I think if you're like the communications coordinator at Red Bull, it probably, you know, might have your heart in the throat, you know, in an interview saying, well, you know, if he gets asked, you know, a controversial question, how is he going to respond? But, you know, as a fan and somebody in the media, I find that a little bit refreshing. But, you know, just before we go on to the next story here, Mark, I was just thinking too, just like you're saying about these young, marketable, personable drivers. One of the moments that stood out from DTSS season 3 was the one with Sainz and Norris. And I thought it was really funny that I think it was at the beginning of that episode where Lando calls up Carlos. And I don't know if Carlos was messing with him. And he kept like, you know, he's talking to him. And then he's like, don't you know who this is? And he's like, it's Lando. And he's like, who? And then, you know, Lando just completely loses it. He just goes into like this, has this fit of hysterical laughter. You know, I thought it was so funny because, you know, I could see myself, you know, well, obviously, I'm not 21 anymore, but I could totally see that, you know, like me doing that with my friends, you know, even at this age, kind of, you know, like, you know, pulling the chain and just sort of jerking one of your friends around. I thought that was a really funny moment. But
before we go into the next story, I'm going to derail a little bit more, and I promise the listeners that this is the last time we'll reference Drive to Survive this episode.
Well, at least the segment.
After the Bottas George Russell crash last weekend, simultaneously a million Drive to Survive memes popped up, which is Netflix getting excited after that crash happened. And there was a million hilarious memes just about the fact that their entire season is made. They're gonna have like a 7-episode story arc about that crash, and they're as ecstatic as we all are to see how it's going to play out this time next year.
Shoot, we gotta wait now like another 11 months before that next drop happens. But hey, sticking with McLaren and sticking with the younger driver thing, this is a nice segue because Carlos Sainz believes that Ferrari can actually be ahead of McLaren at some of the tracks this season. And I thought it was really interesting this past weekend, especially on that long start finish straight that we see at Imola, and then going into Tamburello, that really, well, where the big accident between Bottas and George happened. But I was, I have to admit, I was impressed with the straight line speed that I saw from the Ferrari. I mean, it wasn't top end like we've seen in previous years, and maybe not as top end as say some of the Mercedes powered cars, but it definitely, it was noticeable. Let's just put it that way.
Absolutely. And you and I talked about this a lot in the offseason. And I think you and I had ultimately come to the conclusion that Ferrari, and it sounds really weird to even be saying this, but Ferrari could very much be a sleeper this year. And I think they acknowledged in the offseason that they had solved their power unit issues. And I think you and I both know what that means. And if you don't know what I'm referring to, please go back and visit some of our offseason episodes. But they'd also address some of the drag issues that were really proving to be challenging for last year's car. But absolutely, you can certainly see it in their straight line acceleration and the immense punch that the Ferrari cars have coming out of some of the tighter corners this year is absolutely pronounced. And even when you see them on some of the straightaways competing with cars that would walk past them last year is really encouraging for this team, to be totally honest. And right now they're sitting fourth in the constructors. It's early. They're 7 points behind McLaren. Mm-hmm. But I don't see any reason why those two teams couldn't have a monumental battle as the season goes on. Now, I'm not entirely certain how much more Ferrari's going to invest in this year's car relative to what they're going to start investing in the 2022 car. But I think we could see some really great battles between McLaren and Ferrari as the season progresses.
Yeah, I certainly hope that that's the case. I mean, Ferrari needs to step it up. Obviously, they've been pretty disappointing over the past year and a half or so. And it's really encouraging to see that. And, you know, pun intended, they could be a bit of a dark horse this year. And yeah, I know it groans all around. But yeah, I mean, it is good to see. And it would be fun to see them kind of fighting it back and forth. But more to your point about when are teams going to sort of draw that line in the sand and say, okay, this is as much as we're willing to invest in time and money with this car, and we're going to start focusing on next year. The big question mark is really Mercedes, right? I mean, they, you know, right, as Toto Wolff says, is, you know, we're chasing perfection. That's what we're after. And it would really be interesting that if and when they decide to call it a day on this car and focus more that, okay, this car is only for the remainder of this year, but this next car that's going to be introduced for 2022, this is the first car of a whole new generation, a whole new era in Formula One. And we've owned this era of Formula One all the way back to 2014, and we want to be just as successful and dominant in this new era. And it just kind of makes you wonder. I mean, not that you're going to throw in the towel or hoist the white flag or whatever you want to say. It just kind of makes you wonder at some point. It's like, yeah, well, we're willing to concede this year with the view that we're going to come back next year and we're really going to bring it.
For the benefit of our younger Drive to Survive generation, and I shouldn't suggest they're all younger because I think a lot of the Drive to Survive fans are of a much broader demographic. Mm-hmm. I know we've got people in their 40s and their 50s and their 60s that are just getting into the sport, but I think it's really important to provide a little bit of context to what you and I are speaking to. I think there's a misperception for people that are new to the sport or that don't watch the sport that the teams show up with a car at the first race of the season, typically Australia, and that's the car that they race through to the end of the season. And in Formula One, that's really not the case. Teams continue to develop and continue to rework the car historically as the season goes on. Now, there's a point where they're often developing two cars. They're developing the car that they're actively racing, but at the same time, they're developing in parallel the car that they plan to race the next season. Now, there's typically is a point in the season where the team says, hey, look, we're going to stop developing the current in-season car because we don't think we're going to make any financial strides, or we're not going to get a return on that capital, or hey, we're just far enough back in the Constructors' Championship that it doesn't matter. And then they shift all their resources to the new car. But your point's a really valid one, right? Like the 2022 car is an entirely different beast. From 2014 until this year, the cars have been, they've looked different. There's been new innovations. We've gone wider. We've had lower spoilers. We've introduced the halo. But fundamentally, the cars have been very similar and they've all been built around the same kind of power unit. Next year's cars are a totally different beast. So I think there's some hard decision making for some of these teams this year, which is how much do we want to invest in a car that we're not going to be carrying over to 2022 at all. Because even though teams typically introduce a new car for a new season, they carry over a lot from the previous year. And maybe not physically carrying over, but conceptually, they move over a lot of concepts. Whatever they're developing for this year's car will have no application to next year's car. But I think what we're really discussing is for teams like Ferrari and Mercedes, how far down that pathway of the season do they continue developing this year's car?
Yeah, you know, you made a ton of great points to that. And the one thing I always find really interesting is that the car that they start the season with, because you always see those incremental updates that they apply, like at the Spanish Grand Prix, and then again through the summer and sort of incrementally throughout the year, that the car that finishes the season is, you know, fundamentally 2, 3, 4, or 5 seconds quicker than the car at the beginning of the season. But the thing is, they all get quicker over the course of the season. You know, the sad thing is, over the past couple of years, everybody's gotten quicker, but Williams is still 2.5 seconds a lap slower than everyone else. But we're going to talk about them, and I got a really interesting story to talk about them, because I think that despite the double DNF at Imola last weekend because of the crashes and whatnot, I think that it was hopefully a positive sign of things to come. And we're going to talk about that and some other stories after we take a quick break here, so don't go away. We'll be back in just a moment. All right. Well, welcome back to the show. And Mark, this was one thing that I thought was really quite interesting. And so this is going back to the cost cap, which is set at $145 million for this year. And of course, you know, we're going to have this sliding scale that's going to go down. It's going to reduce it by $5 million a year over the next couple of years. And so obviously, as we've talked about mostly over the off season when the news was a little bit less frequent than it is right now. But one of the things that they had to do was downsize basically across the board to reduce costs and get under this $145 million cap. And one of the big things that was really interesting after that big crash between George Russell and Valtteri Bottas last weekend is just when you have a car that's a write-off like that, now in this cost cap era, what is going to be the financial implications of that? Because, you know, if you're writing off of a car, you know, you got to have to compensate for that. And that was one of the issues when it came to these sprint races that we're going to be seen or that we're going to see trialed at various races throughout the year this year, was that, you know, teams were afraid that if there was an incident and there was, because every time you go on the track, there is a potential for damage as a result of an accident or just losing a front wing. And nothing in Formula One is cheap. Even if you lose the end of a wing, I mean, you know, it's going to cost money to replace that, because everything, like I say, in Formula One is pricey. But it is certainly very, very interesting that this has been a topic that has kind of percolated up through all the other news after the Emilia-Romagna Grand Prix last weekend.
I agree. And this is it's sad, but one of the first things that I started thinking about after that crash happened, and of course, the principal concern whenever you see a really catastrophic crash like that is, are the drivers okay? Are the drivers okay? Are the drivers okay? But as soon as you realize that they were, I start to look at the remnants of the vehicles, and you start to wonder how much of that is salvageable. And these F1 teams do a phenomenal job. You look at Yuki's car and the fact that they were able to get it on the grid, and the gearbox was split in half, but yet they were able to salvage enough of the car that they could compete in the race. But it's pretty clear that in this race, Bottas's car is effectively a complete write-off. And I think the real concern here is that if you were operating in a world where there were no cost caps, so for Mercedes, for instance, there's no cost cap, it sucks that your car's written off, and it sucks that you're going to have to write a big check. And these cars aren't cheap. Let's be very, very clear. Yeah. A carbon fiber monocoque chassis is 650,000 euro to €1 million. All of the parts on this Mercedes car are completely bespoke. Everything's carbon fiber. They're all space age materials. Like, these cars cost millions of dollars to assemble. For Mercedes, it kind of sucks because we just have to cut a check. But now, to your point, the financial implications are, hey, we all have to operate under a cost cap. And if we're close to that cost cap, ultimately this erodes our development budget. So maybe those upgrades that we were hoping to roll out in 2 or 3 weeks or a month, maybe we have to make some tough decisions, because we have to take the money that we were going to invest in upgrades and rebuild the car the way it was just so we can compete in the next race. And for another team like Williams, it's historically less about, hey, you know what, we're going to hit the cost cap or we're going to have to cut a check, but rather, where's that money going to come from? And we saw that in Drive to Survive last year, where Gunther Steiner's having that really difficult conversation with Gene Haas. And ultimately, the underlying message of that was, Gene's like, I'm not going to cut any more money. I'm not going to cut any more checks if our drivers are making stupid mistakes. Like, we don't have that level of income because we're not collecting Constructors' Championship points at the rate the other teams are. And from a sponsorship perspective, we're in a very vulnerable position. So, yeah, it's interesting how this plays out. Now, again, the cost cap is designed to level the field, right? Like, you know what? Mercedes can't spend $1 billion anymore, and Williams is going to be in a position where they're going to compete a little bit more favorably versus some of the big fish because the budget cap's going to be in a place, at least in a couple years, which they can manage. But yeah, it's funny. The first thing I thought when I realized both those drivers were okay is, what is the financial implications of this crash going to be to both of those two teams?
Yeah, you know, it is really funny because it was really one of these sort of unintended consequences when you know, this whole cost cap thing came in. And first when it was a discussion, then it became a thing. My natural sort of instinct and my initial thoughts were, okay, well, that means that they're going to have to cut out of development. They're going to have to cut here and they're going to have to cut there and personnel. I never even considered something like this. And when I saw these stories popping up over the past several days, I'm just like, wow, this is something that we never even thought about. And I think it's good too, because just you're a team that is one of the select few that basically has unlimited resources. Like you say, it sucks for Mercedes because they have to write a check to build a new car. But again, you shouldn't be able to just buy your way out of a situation. Because you know on the other side of the pit lane or further down the pit lane, Williams is having to do the same thing. They're going to have to build a whole new car to replace George Russell's car, and they don't have these bottomless pockets and big stacks of cash. And for them, it's a much bigger issue. I mean, for Mercedes, it's a bit of an issue for the money, but it's more of an inconvenience, right? And I think that's where the cost cap is a really interesting it's a really interesting proposition now, because now, like you say, it's just they're going to take both of these cars. They're going to look through and see, okay, well, what is salvageable? Because, like you say, all the parts are bespoke. All of them are basically handmade and unique to those cars. I mean, I know there is these listed and unlisted parts and things like that, but I mean, it's very, very interesting and something I didn't really expect.
One thing I'll add as well, and I think this is important for our listeners to understand, especially if you're new to the sport, we keep alluding to the 2022 car. And I think what's really important to understand is Formula One is trying to create a reality of economic sustainability. And I think they came to this realization that we can't be in a world where we have one or two teams that can spend $400-500 million a year developing their car, and we have these other teams that can barely spend $100 million developing their car. Yeah. We're never going to have parity. Mercedes will dominate every single year. Ferrari will always dominate. So the reality is, part of introducing the cost cap is we want to create some parity in the sport. But the cost cap can't work if the teams are continuing to develop bespoke parts. So one of the biggest things about the 2022 car is that we're going to see significantly more standardization of parts shared across all of the teams. So teams will continue to be able to develop a power unit or source power units, and there's certain formula that they all have to adhere to. But more of the parts on the 2022 cars will be standardized across all of the teams than we've possibly ever seen. So that's one of the ways that ultimately this cost cap is going to work, because the teams aren't necessarily going to be spending $17,000 on a bespoke halo, and they're not going to be spending necessarily $150,000 on a new front wing every 3 months as it continues to go through multiple iterations. The formula is going to be imposed upon them, and there'll be much, much stricter guidelines on what that part can look like, which is intended partly to dampen performance to an extent, but ultimately inject some financial sustainability in the sport.
You know, it was funny. I was watching some classic F1 races on YouTube last week, and there was I'm not sure what it was. I think it was a couple of years ago. It was at Brands Hatch, and they had a lot of 1980s era Formula One cars. It was just amazing. And one of the whole reason I was watching this one video, because they had a McLaren MP44, which still has to be one of my favorite Formula One cars of all time. If you're not familiar with it, just Google it up. MP44, just a beautiful car, and just the sound of that turbo Honda. engine was just something else. But, you know, it's funny when you go and look at the pictures and you look at the front wing of a car from the 80s or the 90s, maybe even as into the early 2000s, you look at it, that looks like really plain, you know. And then you look, I mean, especially a couple of years ago before they brought in these rules to kind of simplify the front wings, I mean, they are just amazing pieces of technology, the way that they sort of layer these different different levels on the front wings. I mean, they're a little bit simplified to what they were even 2 or 3 years ago at this point, but just amazing. But of course, I mean, you know, a car that you have in Formula One now compared to, say, some of the ones that some of the drivers that changed to new teams this year, they were able to drive some of the older spec cars that were, what, maybe 2017, 2018. Even those cars are so obsolete compared to what they have on the track right now. I mean, it's amazing at the speed that it does progress in Formula One. So, Mark, before we go into our final break here, I just want to touch on this really quickly because we've been going around a little bit on this one and hinting at it. And again, just going back to the big crash between Bottas and Russell, Valtteri was saying, because I know that you love having a Valtteri Bottas story to talk about each and every week, but he feels he doesn't break the, you know, hockey has the code, but apparently yeah. Formula One has, you know, gentlemen's rules, and that this is basically that you don't, you know, make evasive maneuvers under braking, is very much like the Max Verstappen slide and the rule that they brought in back in 2015 or 2016 or whatever it was. Anyways, Valtteri believes that he didn't do anything. He feels that the in-car camera was justified. Russell is still, he's still pointing the finger at Valtteri. And, you know, like we talked about in the post-race show a couple of days ago, that without that overhead helicopter shot or a better shot from off the track, or maybe even a more from George's car, it was really kind of hard to tell, because it did look like Valtteri did glide a little bit to the right there. And of course, Russell reacted to something and he got onto that wet grass. And of course, the rest is history.
I agree. And I think it was the camera from Kimi that was following the two cars. And you're right. There wasn't a clear, decisive black and white shot that showed that he either was or wasn't at fault. But the closest that I've seen, and I think it was Kimi's car, was there was footage from the car that was pursuing the two of them immediately before the accident happened. And I must have watched it 5,000 times. And I can see a little bit of movement from Bottas's car. And I'm talking a fraction, which on track may have translated to 4 or 5 inches, but ultimately it was Russell that reacted. He should have known better. But again, this isn't an adjudication of who was at fault and who wasn't at fault. But ultimately, I do think it's interesting the way that this one's played out. It's a unique situation, right? Because ultimately, Russell's long-term, short-term, medium-term ambitions is to be driving Valtteri's car. But in the process of this accident, he cost his potential employer many millions of dollars in part replacement costs. And it's also challenging because the team principal for the team that he hopes to drive for is also his personal manager. It's just, it's a very unique kind of interconnected spider web of soap opera. But ultimately, I'm still, and I know that's not the question that you asked me, but I'm still out to lunch a little bit in terms of who was at fault here, but I tend to actually side a little bit with Bottas, and I feel a little bit bad for him because I don't necessarily think that he was at fault, and I don't think he was really stepping off of the racing line in a problematic way. Like, you've had a week to reflect on this now. Like, your thoughts, was Russell at fault? Was Bottas at fault? I'm curious to know.
Yeah, I've thought about it quite a bit since the race. I think they're both at fault. I don't think it's like 50-50. It's probably like 70-30 or 80-20 or something like that. And it did look like Bottas did go to that one side, but without that clear-cut camera angle, it really, you really lose the amount that he's moving over, if you know, that's just, you know, actually what happened, right? So I think that you could apportion blame to both of them. But as you just said, I think that George did overreact more. I mean, but as soon as he got onto the grass, I mean, he was just going to be a passenger. Because, I mean, if you go back to DTS Season 2, when they talk about that race at Hockenheim, when it was all wet and it was just chaotic, I mean, Bottas, he crashed it and put it into the wall. I mean, everybody went off the track in that race at one point. He talks about how he got onto the white paint on the edge of the track. He said it wasn't by much. It may have only been millimeters, but I mean, that's really what it takes. And again, it goes back to what we were saying the other night on the post-race show, that this is an old school track. It's not like, say, the more modern track where they could literally drive several cars down one of these straightaways line abreast, that this is basically only wide enough under normal circumstances for maybe two cars to go around or, you know, drive side by side if there's going to be an overtaking maneuver. And unfortunately, George, for one reason or another, due to his own overreaction or being pushed or a combination of both of those factors, he's the one that went onto the grass. And at that point, he was just a passenger, collected to Valtteri. And sadly, the accident happened. But fortunately, like you say, both of them were okay. And that's ultimately
where,
what happened.
Where Valtteri is totally at fault, though, and this is an apt criticism. If you were driving arguably the best car on the grid, you have no business being in a position on the
racing
track.
Williams?
Yeah, where you're competing with the Williams car, right?
Yeah.
Like, you're exposing yourself and you're making yourself vulnerable when you're fighting for track position with what are effectively inferior cars. Mm-hmm. This is the kind of thing that can happen when you're not racing for a podium position at the front of the track and you start mixing it up with these other cars. So whereas I don't necessarily think that I would apportion most of the blame to Bottas for the collision, I absolutely fault him for being in that position to begin with.
He should have
and
been
I
there.
Think Exactly. He should not have been there at all.
Well, I mean, this is something that we've seen before. I mean, go back to Turkey last year when similar horrible, greasy conditions. I mean, you look at some guys. We know that Max is good in the wet. We know Lewis is good in the wet. I mean, there's other drivers throughout the different eras of Formula One, like Schumacher and Senna. These were guys that were just absolute masters in the wet. And you look at Bottas going back to Turkey last year. I mean, he had several incidents spinning. He was way behind his teammate. I can't remember. Did he get lapped by Lewis at the end of the race? He may have done or was close to it. So, I mean, he just obviously is somebody that just does not race well in the wet. Anyways, Mark, I know that you want to sit here and talk for at least another 25 minutes about Valtteri Bottas, but I'm going to cut you off there. We're going to take one final break here on the show, and we're going to come back, and we're going to talk about your second favorite topic, and we're going to talk about Red Bull because we haven't talked about them just yet. We'll do so in just a moment. So don't go away. We'll be right back. All right. Well, welcome back to the show. And Mark, as I promised, we've got our mandatory and obligatory Valtteri Bottas story under the belt again for this week. And I know this is a story that, maybe it doesn't get under your skin as much as the Bottas stories that I seem to plague you with each and every week. But I know that you love talking about Red Bull. But this one I think is interesting. I think it's worth talking about. So obviously, this is their last year, their partnership with Honda. So far, it's been pretty good, pretty successful. Two races into the season, that is, of course, but they are now targeting the best and top talent as they set off on building their own engine division. And I think it's going to be really cool to watch to see what these guys are going to do as an out-and-out works team. And I think that it seemed just in general, regardless if this whole Honda situation came about or not, it just kind of, for me, and maybe hindsight is 2020, but it kind of seemed that they were in a bit of an odd spot as it, where they were. I mean, they've been a very successful team over the years. I mean, they won a number of championships about 10 years ago in the Sebastian Vettel era. And I mean, they've been obviously not quite as successful in the meantime, but maybe this is what they really need to do or needed to do. And they were just nudged in that direction to really get back to being, a real legitimate, consistent contender in Formula One, become a works team in their own right, a manufacturer of both car and engine.
I absolutely love this story. One, I think it's heartbreaking that Honda's leaving the sport.
Agreed.
Again,
yes.
I think this is the third or fourth time that they're leaving. I also think it's a little bit odd, though, that their contribution to the sport this time around hasn't been as a works team, but rather simply as an engine supplier. The cost of developing a power unit is absurd. It's significantly more expensive to develop a power unit than it is to develop the package that goes around it. So I always thought it was a little bit peculiar that when Honda came back into F1 in 2015, it was solely as an engine supplier. And I think my thought was maybe their short-term ambitions were to develop a power unit with the long-term ambition of being able to stand up a works team as a whole. And that never happened for a number of different reasons. But I do have to say that cosmetically, the Honda banner on the wing of the Red Bull looks amazing.
It's eye-catching.
Yeah, it's really, really eye-catching. And I'm very, very happy that Honda's been able to find some success in the sport before their departure, because it would have been awful for their lasting legacy in Formula One to have been their experience with McLaren. For whatever reason, it didn't work out. But I'm very, very happy that they've seen some success with Red Bull. But I'm also incredibly excited for all the reasons that you just spoke to, that Red Bull's been in the sport for a decade and a half. They've won 4 Constructors' Championships, 4 Drivers' Championships. Even in the V6 turbo hybrid era when they were running the Renault engines, they were outperforming the works team from which they were buying those engines from. Like, they're a well-resourced team. They have very, very significant financial backing. They do things the right way. And I'm very, very excited to see what this would look like. So for those of you that don't know, Red Bull's operation is based out of Milton Keynes. Milton Keynes is a newer British city, a little less than an hour from Silverstone. They have all of their development there. Their paint, their wind tunnels there, their paint shops there. They do all of their work there. When Honda and Red Bull partnered up, the engine was being partly developed in the UK, but the bulk of the heavy lifting was happening in Japan. So the heavy lifting from an R&D perspective was happening in Japan. When they bought the IP, what didn't come with that IP was necessarily the production facilities. And again, based on the fact that they're in Japan, that's not particularly helpful. So they're building from the ground up an entirely new facility in Milton Keynes to accommodate the development of the engine going forward. So to your point, I'm excited to see what this team can do from a works perspective. And not just because they're bringing that engine internally, but because, one, they have the resources to continue to develop it in a meaningful way, but because the foundation of the power unit that they have now is so freaking good. And again, we're going to change power units in a couple of years. But for the next couple of years, they've got one heck of a package. The chassis's great, the suspension's great, the steering geometry's great, the aero in this car is great, and then they've got this incredibly powerful power unit package tucked into that car. I'm super, super excited for this team.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that the stars are lining up nicely for them this year, that they have so many good things going for them right now. And I think that's, again, we were talking a little earlier about Danny Ricciardo's lukewarm start to the season. Sergio Perez as well.
Yeah.
It's, you know, I don't want to hate on him too much because I think he's maybe just trying a little bit too hard. I mean, he's obviously there and he knows he's got a good car. And last weekend was a bit of a hard one to really put a lot of judgment on. And just because the conditions were so tricky and so many people put it off the track at one point or another. But it was just, it worked out really, I think, I don't want to say worst case scenario because they still won the race, but it was just unfortunate for Red Bull just in the Constructors' Championship point or side because Perez finished in, what, P11 or something like that. So he didn't even collect a single point. And you know that maybe he might not have been on the podium in that race, but if he was top five, then that would have kind of closed things up. And as we talked about after the race that, this might be one of those, it has the potential, let's put it that way, that it might be one of those races that they come to kind of rue and kind of shake their fist at the end of the year. But anyways, we'll wait and see. But yeah, I mean, just going back to the whole thing that they're going to have their own engines and they're going to be an outright manufacturer. I think it's exciting. I'd love to be in the production facility right now just to see built up from basically from nothing into the state-of-the-art facility. I mean, it's pretty cool. I mean, there's going to be obviously some overlap between the current situation to the new one, and it's not going to happen overnight, but I don't know, things like that I find it's pretty exciting, and I think it's good too because, I mean, it's also a good sign that they're committed to the sport for the long term as well. And another thing that I was just thinking about too was Max Verstappen, how he was looking back and reflecting about how good his start was at Imola on the weekend. I mean, he started in the second year and I mean, he had tons of grip. I mean, he was able to take it to Lewis right from the very start. And of course, the two of them had a little bit of argy-bargy going into that first corner at the chicane there at the end of Tamburello. But it was quite something. I mean, if you looked at you go back and you look at the replay from the race start, you look at poor old Sergio Perez. I mean, he's got a lot of wheel spin there just fighting for grip. But Max just, he leapt off the start line there.
That was absolutely a great start. And really, that's where all started going sideways for Perez, right? Like he was so great on Saturday. And again, I commented on this last weekend, which was, I was excited coming out of qualifying because I was thinking, Red Bull's cracked it, right? If the past couple of years, you've had this premier 1A driver in Verstappen, but you've struggled to pair him with anybody that could put you in contention for a Constructors' Championship. And after qualifying, you had Perez ahead of Verstappen, and I was so excited, but I was ultimately hugely let down at that start where Verstappen quickly slips ahead of both Lewis and Perez. And really, his race just went sideways from there. And to your point as well, ultimately finishing out of the points is something that they'll probably rue. The only saving grace ultimately for Red Bull during that race was Bottas as well, ultimately finished out of the points. I just want to add as well, I've never driven a Formula One car. I have no idea what it's like. I know based on everything that I've heard, it's one of the most physically demanding things that a human being can do when partnered with machinery. Ultimately, the work that the drivers do to stay in shape to be able to drive these cars is absolutely absurd. But driving one of these cars in the rain is something that requires tremendous skill. Like, let's be honest, these cars don't have traction control. They're not all-wheel drive. They don't have limited slip differentials that can shift the torque from the front to the back to compensate for a lack of grip in the wet. When it comes to driving these cars in the wet, it's all driver. It's all driver. And you have to consider as well that not only is it incredibly difficult to keep these cars on the track, keep the heat in the tires, from a visibility perspective, they can see nothing. Right? Like, the only thing between them and the track is their visor, and their visor is covered in slimy, greasy, oily water from the track. It's incredibly, incredibly difficult. But ultimately, Verstappen won that race based on his start, and Perez lost the weekend based on his start. And to your point as well, I'm still cautiously optimistic that he's going to have a good year. I think he's probably nervous. It's the best car he's ever been paired with, but ultimately I don't think there's any chance of him retaining this seat after this year if he continues to put up performances like this and cost this team the opportunity to chase a Constructors' Championship.
You know, it'd be so frustrating for Christian Horner thinking, okay, yes, I've got a guy that, you know, he's better than the other drivers that we've had in the past, but he's just not able to do it consistently. And then, you know, you've got Pierre Gasly again at AlphaTauri, who's been pretty solid in his return since being demoted to go back to that team from Red Bull.
If you're Red Bull right now, you can't win, right? You
no,
promote
you can't.
Gasly, who's one of your internally developed drivers. He doesn't work out, you demote him. You promote Albon, he doesn't work out, he leaves, or he's pushed out of that seat. You do something that you never do, which is sign an outside driver. He underperforms. Like, they just can't win with that second driver right now.
Yeah, it's almost like a bit of a curse to be that Red Bull driver number two. It's just whoever it is can't really win. Hey, Mark, just a couple more stories as we start to wind it down here. We talked about it, I hinted at it a little bit earlier on, but Williams, they had what was a really good weekend, got both cars into Q2. Sadly, both of them crashed out during the race. Nick Latifi, he did go on to say that he didn't actually realize that Mazepin. Sorry, yeah, was there when he tagged him. And, you know, I've completely flip-flopped on that to put most of that on Latifi, but also then the crash of George Russell. But it was disappointing because they were looking so good, and I mean, compared to what we're used to, obviously getting both cars into Q2, like I said, and they were looking decent-ish during the race. I mean, Russell was running well in the points until he had his accident, and it's just it's got to be frustrating for them. But hopefully, if you're Williams, that you've seen something there that maybe, finally, maybe you've turned the corner and you're starting to dig yourself out of this really deep, dark, nasty hole that you've been stuck in with little hope over the past several years.
I completely agree. And I think it's frustrating for a couple of reasons. One, because there was so much hope going into Sunday. The fact that you had both drivers going to Q2, the fact that Latifi actually outperformed George Russell in Q1 for the first time ever. I think that was a bit of a breakthrough for Latifi.
Yeah, that was awesome.
For his confidence. Everything looked really great. And if they'd gone into the race weekend and they brought both of the cars home and maybe they'd scored a couple of points, the weekend would have been perfect. But the challenge for this team is not only do they score no points, not only do they DNF both cars, but to our earlier point, they pick up massive repair bills for both of those cars. And this isn't one of those teams that's in a position where they can continue to cut checks simply because they don't have the revenue streams that some of these bigger teams have. So it was really a heartbreaking weekend because emotionally you're on such a high going into the race Sunday, and then everything went wrong on the race day. And not only do you DNF both those cars, but you pick up those big repair bills as well. Hopefully this team can still build on this weekend, right? Ultimately, Sunday wasn't successful. The Grand Prix itself didn't play out the way I think they would have liked to have, but hopefully they can build on the qualifying. That's something they can point to. Like, look, we had both the cars in Q2. Latifi out-qualified Russell in Q1. Hopefully that's something they can build on going into Portugal.
Yeah, and I mean, if it doesn't race before that start of that Grand Prix, who knows what happens when, exactly, when the track is dry. I mean, I think that, you know, if you're at Williams, be it, you know, the team principal down to the guy that, you know, that's running the cafeteria and stocking the coffee and everything like that, I think you have to take positives where you can find it, because you don't often get a wet race in Formula One. We get a couple every year, and it was just that after so many good things that happened prior to that, it just had you know, a really negative outcome that wasn't, it was all out of their control, basically. I mean, Nick did the best to get the car back on the track, and then he was just struggling to get, you know, keep the grip. And, you know, he said it was like a nightmare out there. It was some of the worst conditions. Probably, I think he said it was the worst conditions he'd ever driven a race car in, wasn't it? So, yeah. And then, you know, of course, George's big crash there. I mean, those were both circumstances that were out of basically everybody's hands. I mean, it was out of Nick's hand. I mean, he had cold tires. He's on a greasy track. George lost it on the getting one wheel or a couple of wheels on the grass. And it just a couple of, like, basically an eye, you know, blink of an eye for both drivers ruined their weekend. But I think you just got to take positives where you can take it. And there's just try and build some momentum, because, I mean, it's been painful to watch them. I mean, not just at the back of the grid, but so fundamentally slower than the next slowest car in front of them for the past couple of years. And I think you just take what you can and just move forward.
You know, I think it's useful for our listeners, especially the newer listeners, to understand that while they really haven't been successful during this era, and that's actually a dangerous comment, because if you flash back to 2014, the first year of the turbo hybrid era, they were fourth in the Constructors' Championship.
Yeah, exactly, right?
I think that probably in hindsight had less to do with their own development, but rather the fact that so many of the other teams were behind in development of that chassis. But that said, they scored a few podiums in 15, they scored podiums in 16. In 2017, they scored a podium with Lance Stroll in Baku, yep. But they haven't even been close since. 2018, they completely cratered. 2019 was a devastating year. 2020 was a devastating year. I hope that they can continue to build on that qualifying session. I think what's really important for this team this year is they have to score some points. You cannot go three championship seasons in Formula One without scoring any points. But no, it is important to recognize that back in the 80s and 90s, the 90s especially, this was absolutely a premier team in Formula One. They were winning Constructors' Championships. They were winning drivers' titles. And for our Canadian listeners, the sole Canadian to have won a F1 driver's title was Jacques Villeneuve with Williams back in 1997.
Yeah, a funny story here, just before we wrap it up with the final story. I actually met Jacques Villeneuve.
Really?
Yes, yeah, in a Soyuz, which is a small town in the Okanagan in the interior of British Columbia. Yeah. This is going back to about 2012, 2013. Anyways, we vacation up there quite frequently during the summers, and we were at this resort there. Yeah, humble brag. And we were just visiting, and we went into this one resort that we were just went up. We were at, and we noticed that there was something going on. There was like a bunch of police cars and some fire trucks and things like that. And you know, having little kids, you know, anytime you see police cars and fire trucks and firemen and stuff like that, it's like a magnet, right? So we go, and then I look inside, and I see like a couple of go-karts walk in, and all of a sudden I see this big, tall, really big guy. And this big guy turned out to be Gino Ojic. So if you're a Vancouver Canucks fan, everybody knows who Gino is. You know, very famous player for the Canucks. Anyways, he's talking to this smaller, slight guy, kind of thinning on top, got little round spectacles on. And I'm like, well, I'll be damned. If that isn't Gino Ojic and Jacques Villeneuve. So I went over and talked to Jacques, and you know, they were signing autographs and everything like that. And they were both really awesome with the kids. And it was just, you know, I never expected, you know, on a family vacation to run into a Formula One driver, a former Formula One driver, let alone a former world champion. So that was
cool. I don't think I need to tell you this, but there is a new motorsport park just north of Oliver, north of Soyuz, where
that's
you
right.
were, called Area 27,
yeah.
which was designed by Jacques Villeneuve. And perhaps that was the reason he was up there, was he was scoping out the geography for his new track.
He could have been. That's really quite possible. Yeah, it was really cool. It was a really neat moment. So finally, Mark, we get to the end of the show and where to wrap it up. But, you know, my little teaser right off the very beginning. It wasn't necessarily the premier story of the entire show, but I thought it was funny. It was just the whole saga that poor old Kimi Raikkonen had to put up with this, you know, during the race last weekend. So he was pushed out of the points, you know, because of all of this. Anyways, it all had to do with the, you know, the red flag and then all this, you know, this standing start and stuff like that. But anyways, before the restart, Kimi, he spun at turn three. He lost several places. And then this is where it really gets really confusing. We tried to figure this out. We talked about it, you know, after the race. And anyway, so he was able and entitled to retake his position before he got to the first safety car line. The team got on the radio, told him to stay where he was, and then at that point, he was actually supposed to and was obligated to restart from the pit lane. So they weren't really all that clear as to what was going on. So they got on the race radio to Michael Massey, who's the race director. They got no response for him. And then after the race, even the steward said that the rules are unclear and they contradict each other. And they said, but that notwithstanding, you still have to have a 10-second stop-go penalty applied for breaking the rules. So since it was issued after the race, it became a 30-second time penalty for Kimi, and that dropped them from P9 all the way down to P13. And you know, it's I can't do anything except to shake my head, and I can't imagine how frustrated Kimi Raikkonen must be feeling about that.
Can you help me understand what happened here? So
I wish I could. I can't
wrap my head around this. So there was a crash. And the race was temporarily red flagged.
Yeah.
And typically, if a race is red flagged, you go back and you have another grid start. But they decided that they were going to have a rolling start. Mm-hmm. At some point, Kimi spun out before the rolling starts. He didn't retake the position that he had before the spin, and then somehow he ended up being I can't wrap my head around this. And then the sport just steps in and changes the rule to make sure it doesn't happen, like mid-season. It's very, very, very odd.
Yeah, they go and change, you know, they admit that their own rules don't make sense, but hey, you know, we're going to give you a penalty. And it used to be, if you served it during the race, it was 10 seconds, but because we're applying it after the race, we're going to hit you a 30-second penalty, and we're going to drop you out of the points.
It's crazy.
And, you know, don't complain about it, because that's just the way it is. You know,
it's just sports got to be really careful with stuff like this, right? Like if you're catering now to millions, potentially millions of new fans, you can't come across as being so arbitrary. Like in the first race, we talked so much about track limits.
Yeah.
Like, well, Mercedes clearly neglected any concept of track limits for the first 2/3 of that race.
Yeah.
And then ultimately track limits became an issue with other drivers towards the end of the race. And then, yeah, like the sport's got to demonstrate a greater sense of consistency. And even just the look of, hey, we're just going to change rules midway through a season so that a rule that was in effect for this race no longer applies to the next race. It's confusing for the drivers and the teams and the fans, but the arbitrary nature of some of the calls is really problematic. And I'm sure you saw the memes as well. Like I saw a video on, I think, Reddit or somewhere that showed the frequency with which Mercedes were flagrantly ignoring track limits for the first 2/3 of that race to begin the season. Like, yeah, it's just dangerous. Like you have all these new fans. You need to show them that you know how to manage and officiate the sport.
Yeah, exactly right, and I think that's why that Bahrain Grand Prix was so ironic, that the defining moment came down to that turn four and Max exceeding the track limits by obviously quite a large margin, and then, you know, he had to give the position back, which was the right thing to do. I mean, he gained an advantage by exceeding the track limits, and of course, you know, he did the right thing, even though it must have really been painful for him. But it's like you say, I mean, you had the Mercedes guys exceeding the track limits. limits there for so long during the race. And they said that okay, this is where the track limits are going to be before the race started, or the weekend started, but they just didn't enforce it. It's just like, you know, an apple is an apple is an apple. It either is or it isn't. You know, you just can't decide halfway through a race that, okay, well, we're going to have track limits at turn four, but okay, well, these guys have been doing it and now it's not, you know, they either exceeding track limits or it's not. Or it's like this whole BS with Kimi Raikkonen and all this sort of, like you say, the arbitrary application of rules. It's just, it's maddening. I just read that whole summation in the online and I just like, you know, I can't even get my mind around this. I'm not even going to try and understand the logic. I'm just going to laugh as loud and as ironically and sarcastically and disparagingly as I can and just kind of move on with my life, because this deserves absolutely no attention. But like you say, I mean, if they don't, I mean, they risk turning people off, because it just, it looks garbage. It looks like, you know, Bush League stuff, and they have to do better.
And I don't fault the drivers, right? If I'm a driver and I'm fighting for position and my job's on the line and I'm fighting for points and I'm fighting for a contract, I will push the track limits as far as I can. And if I sense that the race stewards and the officials aren't going to call me, I'm going to push them as far as I can. And for the better part of that race, they weren't calling them. And I don't fault the Mercedes drivers for flagrantly throwing that back in the face of the sport. But ultimately, it's the responsibility of the sport to step in and officiate track limits, as it is all of the rules in the sport.
You know, when going back to Bahrain now, I mean, not to drag it too much out any further, but it may have happened rather innocently and benignly in that race. Maybe Lewis exceeded the track limits a couple of times, or maybe Valtteri did, or maybe they both did, and maybe somebody on the, you know, on the pit walls looking at us like, hey guys, you know, both of you exceeded the track limits, but they're not saying anything about it, so, you know, why not push it a little bit until we get a message from from the race director saying, hey, you guys, you got to cool it, or else you're going to get a black and white flag, you're going to have your times deleted or something like that. I mean, if they're not going to enforce it, why not try and gain an advantage? I mean, it's a gray area. I mean, it kind of is cheating, but if they're not going to enforce it, they're turning a blind eye to it. Is it cheating? I don't know. And that's where it is. That's why I say you either have these rules and enforce it. It's either when it comes to, and we talked about it too, about the unlapping of cars and all that, but also like for Kimi, where he had to regain his position, or the pit lane start or not, or the track limits. It's like you have rules there for a reason, and you either enforce them or you don't, right?
One of the things that's always driven me crazy about baseball, for instance, is the umpires demand so much of the influence over a specific game, right? Like, you know, at the beginning of a game, look, the umpire isn't going to be calling things on the outside corner of the plate. And ultimately, it's a strike. But for whatever reason, that umpire has made the decision that he's just not going to call those, or he's not going to call anything inside. But ultimately, it influences the outcome of the game, right? Like, you need to have tactically, strategically called officiating. And you can't have a race where the stewards just decide, hey, you know what, we're just not going to enforce track limits today, but we are going to enforce them next race, because it helps to create this perception of, I don't want to suggest favoritism, but it just ultimately creates this perception of a lack of professionalism. And like I said, one of the things I hated about baseball was ultimately that pitcher could be throwing strikes, but the umpires just decided arbitrarily, I'm just not going to call those as strikes today. I'm going to call those strikes as balls. And I don't like to see that in Formula One. And they should have been calling Mercedes on it earlier in the race. They didn't. And I don't blame Hamilton and I don't blame Bottas, because I'm going to be looking for every single possible advantage that I can in an effort to win that race. So I don't blame them, but I certainly blame the sport for not doing a better job of officiating the track limits.
Well, you know, certainly, like, I think we all can relate to when we were at school. You walk in one day, the teacher's sick, you got a substitute teacher, and every kid's mentality.
Push it as far as you can.
Push those limits and see how much you're going to get away with, because you know that, you know, a day or so later, teacher's going to be back, and things are going to be back to the way that they always were. You're going to try and push limits as much as you can. And on that note, Mark, I think we've pushed the limits as far as we absolutely can for another week. I'm good. I'm ready to wrap it up. I'm ready to to draw a line under this show and just to get ready. I mean, this time next week, we're going to be talking about the Portuguese Grand Prix. I'm looking forward to going back to Portimão. I think that was one of the pleasant surprises of last year. And it's really cool, very much like Imola, to see it back on the schedule for this year. So really looking forward to it. So thank you, my friend. Always a good time. Always glad to talk Formula One with you, and glad to have all of you on board listening and watching the show again this week. And if you want to get in touch with us, by all means, do so. Send us an email at scuderiaf1pod@gmail.com or on Twitter at scuderiaf1pod. And that's it. That's a wrap. And if you want to support us, please do so. Go to Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen, enjoy your podcast, and leave us a rating review. It really helps us grow the show, and we'd very much appreciate it. And we love the support. And that's it. Take care. Have a great weekend. We'll be back very, very soon. And that's it. Bye for now.